Good evening. It is Friday, May 1st, 2020, and it is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. The U.S. is trying to get back to some semblance of normal amidst the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. More than half of U.S. states will partially open by the end of this week, but some are opting to extend their stay-at-home orders in an abundance of caution. The nation's largest owner and operator of shopping malls, Simon Property Group, is set to reopen 49 properties in 10 states in a first wave starting today. Here are the recent numbers of those impacted by the virus. In the United States, we have 1.1 million confirmed cases. We have 133,000 people who have fortunately recovered, and unfortunately, 63,851 people in this country have passed. It's Friday. So we'll kick off today's show the way we do every Friday with my first guest. He's a frequent collaborator with all major news outlets and author of City Builders and Vandals in Our Age, Caleb Maupin. As always, Caleb, welcome back.
Sure. Glad to be here as always.
So it's being reported that senior officials across multiple government agencies met yesterday to begin mapping out a strategy for seeking retaliatory measures against China, blaming China for the COVID-19 virus. Officials in American intelligence agencies are also involved in the effort. Now, last week, we discussed the fact that some states had or were about to file civil lawsuits in U.S. courts for damages against China. Now, the administration is trying to map out a plan. Your thoughts?
Well, Trump continues to stick to this conspiracy theory that the virus was somehow created in a laboratory, when we have the director of national intelligence being very, very clear that it was not genetically modified or created in a lab. This is not a synthetic virus. And it shows that on some level, Trump is being handled. There are people around Donald Trump who would like him to believe this. Now, Donald Trump has said that he has the proof, he's convinced, but he's not allowed to show it to us. Those are his words. He's not allowed to show it to us. But he's the president of the United States.
He said that today, I believe.
Yeah, he's the president of the United States. He can show it to us, right? So who is telling the president he's not allowed to show it to us? And there seems to be a difference within the halls of power over this. And Donald Trump is being surrounded by people who would like him to believe that somehow this is the result of Chinese malfeasance or actions. But the data does not seem to confirm that. And many voices in Europe also have backed up the facts that this simply is not the result of something created synthetically, that the Wuhan virology lab, they're not responsible for this. And there's many holes in that story also. I mean, for example, the Wuhan virology lab was itself funded by the United States government. So would that make us responsible for it? There are many things that don't even add up, even if that claim were to check out, and the claim doesn't check out, according to the scientists who have looked into it.
Wait a minute. Let me just stop you there, because there's a similarly related point. As the president has attacked the WHO and said that the WHO bears some responsibility for either slow response or providing inaccurate information, it is the World Health Organization, and as such, there are American doctors that are part of the World Health Organization. So to your point, if, in fact, the WHO were partially responsible for this, we would be part of that organization as well.
Indeed. And it seems like what's going on here is just an attempt to deflect blame. People are looking at U.S. failures in response to this crisis and the anarchy on some level, with every state doing its own thing, with these protesters storming into the Michigan state capitol. And there, it's an attempt to just kind of direct the blame elsewhere, just kind of push people away from looking at the failures of the United States government, which seems to be unable to govern in a moment like this, and instead putting blame on China on the other side of the world, placing blame at their feet, blaming them for this, when in reality, China was warning the whole world about this. And the U.S. media was accusing China of being authoritarian, calling their lockdown measures extreme. Meanwhile, while China's response to this was being demonized, let's remember, members of Congress were selling their stocks and getting ready for what they knew was coming, but at the same time playing up the idea that China was being heavy-handed. And lo and behold, here we are in this situation, whereas China is coming back to life economically. China has dealt with this and responded to it. They're now sending protective equipment all across the world to deal with it, whereas we here in the United States are kind of scrambling. We've got right-wing protesters wanting us to come back to life immediately. We've got lots of people in the United States who think it's all just a giant hoax. It's all just made up. It's not real. And we're in a state of just utter confusion. And so if you can just blame China, if you can just focus on, China did it, China's responsible, that's a way to distract from the real reality of the situation, which is China gave us plenty of warning. We ignored it, and now we are crashing and burning while China is speeding ahead.
And just to put the final point on this, apparently, two of the actions that members of the administration are discussing would be, one, stripping China of its sovereign immunity, which legal experts have said is damn near impossible. And the other is defaulting on the debt that we owe to China, which would be utterly irresponsible. Your thoughts on those two, and then we'll move on.
Well, the debt with China issue is often misrepresented. But, China, lends that money to the United States, and that's China essentially bailing out the United States. I mean, that's China doing a service to the United States, and that's part of the arrangement that China made when they had their reform and opening up, when American companies started doing business there, is that China would start lending money to the United States. It's not something China wants to do. China's not like a bank. It's not like they're sitting there trying to make money off of lending money. This is something China has kind of been, been forced to do. It's a concession that they had to make in order to allow American corporations to open up. This goes back to the Carter years. So then to not pay back those loans after China's already been kind of forced to handle all this American debt, that's not a particularly nice thing to do to the country. But the way that whole issue is presented is widely misrepresented. People think China is in this to make money. It's like they're buying treasury bonds or something. That's just not the case.
And stripping China of its sovereign immunity.
Yeah. To strip a country that is the largest country in the world in terms of population, the second largest economy in the world of sovereign immunity, good luck with that.
Well said. Well said. You mentioned in this armed gunmen entering Michigan. Let's move there. Armed gunmen entered the Michigan Capitol demanding an end to COVID-19 lockdown, the right-wing movement against public health measures designed to stave off the coronavirus pandemic. It escalated yesterday as armed gunmen were among those who stormed the Michigan State House and tried to enter the legislative chamber. The protesters entered the building after holding a small rally outside the State House. This is in Lansing, Michigan, calling for an end to Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer's stay-at-home order in accordance with guidance from public health experts due to the corona pandemic. Your thoughts not only on this particular event in Michigan, but we are seeing more and more of these measures in this country, and people just seem to accept it as the norm.
Well, today is May 1st, International Workers' Day, and if there were not a pandemic going on in every major city, you'd see trade unions, immigrant workers, socialists, leftists, marching in the streets with red flags, celebrating and observing the holiday. But they made a decision not to do that, as that would violate the orders. And we see the organized political left, even though it's May Day, saying, look, this is not permitted, not getting permits, and just not having its demonstration. Meanwhile, we see the right wing. When I saw that footage, that whole crowd of people packed into the Michigan State Capitol, right? not only are they packed in very, very close, definitely not social distancing. They're not 6 feet away from each other. They are packed in there. But on top of that, they're armed. They have guns. Now, you know, if you walk into government buildings with guns calling for the ouster of an elected official, that's bordering on, you know, insurrection. That's the kind of thing that people get killed for. That's the kind of thing that, you know, that wars start out with, right? This is very serious behavior. And it disturbs me to see this double standard. It seems like there can be no public gatherings, there can be no protests, unless you're on the right wing. And I guess you can do it then. I mean, I don't understand why this was permitted to go on. I don't understand why there was the reaction. I mean, I'm just asking, why is this action that's a clear danger to public health on top of the other very serious concerns being tolerated? And it seems like a very big double standard. But we saw this with the Tea Party as well. You go back to the Tea Party. There are many examples of the Tea Party groups doing things that, again, if a left-wing mob or a left-wing activist group had done them, there would have been a very, very heavy, strong response to. I mean, there seems to just be a tolerance for these right-wing protests in many states around the country, probably due to the fact that local law enforcement, not federal law enforcement, but local law enforcement in the areas that these are going on, are part of the demonstrations and support them. And that's very problematic in my view.
Whenever I see something like this, it reminds me of when I was 8 years old in Sacramento, California. Two dozen armed members of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense entered the California State Capitol in Sacramento. 10 of them made their way to the back of the assembly chamber before they were disarmed and taken away by the state police. To show you, in my opinion, how times have changed and political positions can vary based upon the phenotype of those who are exercising their rights, the Panthers' action so frightened politicians, not only in California, but across this country, including then California Governor Ronald Reagan, that it helped pass what was called the Mulford Act, which was a state bill prohibiting the open carry of loaded firearms, along with an addendum prohibiting loaded firearms in the state capitol. And that 1967 bill took California down the path to having some of the strictest gun laws in the country, and it also helped to jumpstart the surge of a national gun control restriction. Funny how times change, and especially when the phenotype or skin pigment of those involved changes along with it.
Indeed, indeed. And I believe it is legal for them to carry firearms in Michigan.
It was.
I believe it's an open carry state. But at the same time, I feel like the imagery there, the message is particularly problematic. You know, I mean, I was at the 2016 Democratic Convention, where just outside the convention, there was a crowd of guys from this Ohio militia who were walking around with AK-47s. You know, I have a feeling that most countries would just not allow that kind of thing, you know, that you know, we don't want that kind of thing to take place, and we would just not allow that. Maybe law enforcement can have guns, but civilians walking around outside of, you know, government buildings and, you know, public events like conventions with guns, most countries would just say, we don't allow that kind of thing. And I think their instincts would be correct. It's very disturbing to see the toleration of this in certain red states or blue states even.
Iran launched, the Iran satellite launch reveals gains in missile program. Now, last week, we discussed that Iran had launched its first military satellite. The Revolutionary Guard deployed a Ghasid satellite carrier to put the device into space, and it was reported as a previously unheard of system. Today, the Wall Street Journal states the launch marked the coming out of a military program that Tehran has kept mostly under wraps for a decade. U.S. officials and arms control experts say that for Iran, following a path similar to North Korea's, the satellite program likely serves as a guise for the development of intercontinental ballistic missiles. Is this dangerous speculation and U.S. propaganda stoking the flames of anti-Iran rhetoric, or is this really substantive analysis? Iran launches a satellite, and now we take that into comparing them to North Korea and ICBMs.
Indeed. I mean, North Korea withdrew from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and went forward with testing nuclear weapons. Iran is testing its missile system and has launched a peaceful, you know, satellite into orbit. There's very, very big differences there. It seems to me that right now, Iran has been particularly hard hit by this coronavirus pandemic. Iran is sending a message to those who seek to overthrow it, the United States and Israel, those forces that seek to bring down the Islamic Republic, that they are stronger than they might appear, and that their ability to retaliate if attacked is bigger than some might estimate. That's my feeling here about what this is about. I don't think this is a sign that they are preparing to engage in nuclear proliferation or anything to that effect. I think this is simply Iran making clear that while they may look like they are in a vulnerable position right now, they are prepared to defend themselves if attacked.
Fabian Hines, who's a research associate at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies in Monterey, California, said, quote, "It is a very sophisticated program with very sophisticated technology. They can move beyond this if they want. There are strong indications that the Revolutionary Guard's space program is aimed at acquiring long-range ballistic missile technology." I just wanted to give that as an example of how someone just reading this and not really focusing or trying to pick this whole thing apart would read that and could probably be very fearful that Iran is on its way to a missile. But this is really just Fabian Hines pontificating about where the program could go if Iran wanted to take it there. But he doesn't give any insight, and they don't give any time in the article to say Iran has shown really no indication that that's the direction they want to go. So your thoughts on that?
Yes, I mean, there's an old adage about geopolitics that when you take a defensive move, your rival will see it as an offensive move. When your rival takes a defensive move, you will see it as an offensive move. And that seems to be the case. Whenever Iran does what Iran feels would be a situation of defending itself, U.S. media and U.S. voices interpret this as an act of aggression. And that tends to be how international affairs are played out, you interpret the defensive moves of your opponent as offensive. And that seems to be the case here. But it also, there's a lot of money to be made here. Betsy DeVos, you know, Trump's Secretary of Education, her brother is Eric Prince of Blackwater. Bernie Marcus, the owner of Home Depot, has a lot of money tied to the military-industrial complex and playing up the idea that Iran is our enemy. They've got new weapon systems. Therefore, we need lots of weapon systems. And we need all the U.S.-aligned autocracies in the Middle East, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates. We need them to start buying more military hardware. There's a lot of money to be made there. The Middle Eastern arms race, we saw Trump calling for what he called an Arab NATO. A lot of money to be made there for weapons manufacturers. So playing up the idea that we need more weapons because Iran has more weapons, so we need more weapons ourselves, we need to sell more weapons to our allies, lots of money in that.
Caleb Maupin, as always, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate your analysis. Please, for you and yours, continue to stay healthy and have a wonderful, wonderful weekend.
You too. My best.
Thanks, man. Okay, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Bodies are found in unrefrigerated trucks in New York City during COVID-19 pandemic. The city of New York delivered a freezer truck to a funeral home on Wednesday after it was found to be storing dead bodies in unrefrigerated U-Haul vehicles. ABC News reported about 100 bodies were stored in the vehicles after the owner of the Andrew T. Kleckley funeral services funeral home said the freezer that normally stores bodies stopped working. It was not clear how long the bodies had been stored in the U-Hauls or whether any were COVID-19 victims. The bodies were found after neighbors reported an odor coming from the trucks, according to media reports. This does highlight some of the challenges that funeral homes are experiencing during this pandemic. And for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He is the owner of Horton's Funeral Services based in Washington, D.C. It is a family-owned and operated funeral home. Mr. R. Bowman Horton. Mr. Horton, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Thank you, sir. Thank you so much. Okay.
So as the coronavirus pandemic threatens more communities, it appears from the stories I'm reading that funeral directors such as yourself are saying they're having real challenges keeping up with the growing death toll that has already claimed more than 5,000 lives in the United States. Death care workers are considered essential in many states, even though those states have stay-at-home orders. But there seem to be problems with getting cleaning products, and funeral workers are fighting for more safeguards. What's going on? What are you experiencing at your funeral home?
Well, so far, we've been pretty steady. I mean, we had a good supply of the PPE that we needed, but we're running a little low now. And as a matter of fact, I'm also on the D.C. Board of Funeral Directors here in Washington, D.C., and we're having a meeting on Thursday of the 7th of this month, our normal monthly meeting. And we've put a filler out to the mayor to help us get the PPEs for the funeral homes. Because after death, we are the front line. Without a doubt, we are the front line because we have to go to the funeral, to the hospitals, the nursing homes, and retrieve the human remains, bring them into our facilities or to the crematory or to the gravesite. So it puts us at risk. So we need the same kind of care that the healthcare workers are getting before the death. We need it after death because we don't know how long this virus stays alive after death. And there's no proof if the virus dies after death, but we still need the protection. Now, so like I say, I just got the phone with two companies ordering some PPEs for myself and some of the other local funeral homes. I'm, you know, trying to rally them to come together and maybe we can buy them in bulk so that we can get a better price for them. And you know, and to get them, people, they want the bigger order more than the smaller order. So I'm trying to get the funeral homes to come together so we can put out a big order and get them in so we can have what we need to service the families and protect ourselves.
Have you heard about other members of your organization that are having problems anywhere similar to the problems that I described in terms of panic buying and hoarding cleaning products and just having the challenges, as to your point, being the first line of defense after death?
Well, I have not had anyone specifically call me and say they've had any problems getting cleaning products. I mean, we grab them wherever we can grab them. We disinfect whatever we can get. We're getting it. I went to one of my colleagues on in my block, on my street, a couple of blocks from me a few weeks ago to get some PPE that they had that we didn't have. So we're coming together, trying to help each other through this. You know, like I tell people, we've been praying and working through this pandemic. You know, and it's a real challenge. You know, I personally, this incident that happened in New York, you know, which is, you know, it's unacceptable. I mean, it should not happen. It could happen. The motor could have went out, but I don't know if someone daily checking the motor to see if it's running. But I just personally myself purchased a refrigerated trailer because I'm getting myself ready for this because the D.C. medical examiner in a webinar a few weeks ago says that D.C. is supposed to peak in mid-June.
Mm-hmm. So you're preparing for the peak, and you've just purchased a refrigerated trailer.
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm. And because they said DC supposed to have 98 infections in mid-June, and out of that 98, 2% will die. That's like 1,800 deaths, if that holds true. So, and then we're servicing D.C., Maryland, and Northern Virginia. So, you know, we're like a tri-state, so we're servicing all three states, the two states and District of Columbia. So it's something like I never could imagine something like this happen, but we have to stick together and work together and help each other through this. I mean, you know, through anything, if we work together, we'll get through it. You know, we know this will pass. We just hope it passes soon. You know, it's just that it's really some trying times. But you know, I come in every day and service the public and my staff. We service the public, and then we leave and go home to our families, and we do all we can to protect ourselves so that we don't transmit something and take it home to our families. But we do need access to the PPEs, and hopefully the District of Columbia is working. So I heard that FEMA is helping Maryland, the state of Maryland, get PPEs for the funeral homes there. So we're trying to get somebody to step up and help us get ours here in the District of Columbia.
What about how the whole funeral process has changed? As I understand it now, the way that services have to be conducted, a lot of people are turning to online viewing. Mourners are struggling as funeral homes are overwhelmed. And again, the standard come to the funeral home, everyone come together at the funeral home and then go to the gravesite, that a lot of those processes have had to change.
Yeah, because right now, Maryland, D.C., and Virginia, it's a standard that you can only have 10 persons gathering in one location. Mm-hmm. So here in our chapel, and most of the funerals are being handled at the funeral home there because the churches are shut down. Because they've been ruled not essential, so the churches are closed. So just about all the funerals are being held here at the funeral homes. And only 10, and that 10, including that 10, is the pastor who's doing the eulogy. Mm-hmm. So that has changed the way that as far as our services, nothing changed. We do the same thing. We carry out the service the same way that we always have. It's just that you have less mourners there.
Are you seeing that family members of the loved ones of the dearly departed are having struggles with the new limitations that are put on the services?
Oh yeah, it's definitely been tough one, and sitting with them and talking to them, I let them know. I say, I know this hurts, but it's the law. It's what we have to do. I say, I know you want to celebrate the life of this loved one that has passed, but we also have to remember we want to save the life of those that are living, because we don't know how this virus is spreading, but they're telling us to self-distance ourselves. So we have to follow what the health organization is telling us to protect us so that we don't die. So with that, they kind of understand, but I know deep down inside they're hurting.
Sure. Have you noticed an increase in services as a result of COVID-19? Let me put this another way. Let me put it another way. Are you informed that the individual passed as a result of the COVID-19 virus, or are you treating all bodies as though they have it?
Well, we're treating all bodies as though they have it. We have in the District of Columbia, if a person has any inkling that he has COVID, the medical examiner is taken away. Like he said, if a person dies in the home and the family mentions, well, you know, they might have COVID, they said, don't make that removal, call us, the medical examiner, we're coming to get it. Now, that's not holding true in Maryland because they don't have to, the medical examiner doesn't have to pick them up, and they, you know, if even if they are COVID, the medical examiner doesn't have to pick them up because we've picked them up at the hospitals, and they are COVID.
But you are informed.
Well, we're supposed to be. We're supposed to be. We had an incident the other day where we think the person is COVID. The death certificate didn't say it, but we had a situation at a facility, and I told them, I say, this person died on the floor where four other people died who were COVID. And you would tell me this person not infected. They say, well, they were not tested for it. But tested or not, he's in that community with these people.
Got it.
I say, and this is going to put me and my staff at risk.
Final question. Have you had any multiple families where more than one individual in a family has passed in a very close space of time due to the virus?
I have not. So far, everyone's been one individual. And we had our first one was the husband of the family. Now, I understand the wife, she has the infection, but she has not passed yet. The son, he had it. He recovered. So, but no death after death.
Mr. R. Bowman Horton from Horton's Funeral Services, which is based in Washington, D.C. Sir, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your service. And we will talk to you at another time.
You're so welcome. And everybody out there, be safe. And
you too, sir. Be safe and stay healthy. Thank you.
You too, buddy.
Okay, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. It's Friday, so that means it's panel time, and we are joined by a man with a PhD in political economy. He teaches economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California and is the author of the book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump, Dr. Jack Rasmus. As always, Jack, welcome back.
Glad to join you.
We're also joined by a political analyst and commentator and editor of The Polemicist. He is Jim Kavanaugh, and Jim's latest piece, which is entitled Joe or No, can be found at Counterpunch and at The Polemicist as well. Jim Kavanaugh, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So, Jack, let's start with your latest piece, The Myth of the V-Shaped U.S. Economic Recovery, wherein you write, the spin is in. Trump administration economic message bearers Steve Mnuchin, the U.S. Treasury Secretary, and Kevin Hassett, senior economic advisor, this past Sunday on the Washington TV talking head circuit, launched a coordinated effort to calm the growing public concern that the current economic contraction may be as bad or worse than the Great Depression of the 1930s. Take it from there, Jack Rasmus.
Yeah, well, you know, all this talk about V-shaped recovery is based upon the assumption that this is simply a virus-driven contraction, you see, and I don't believe that. I believe the virus has precipitated and accelerated a contraction that was already in the works, and we were moving towards that last year in the global economy and in the U.S. economy. All kind of indicators showed that we were slowing down dramatically. And then this virus hit, but the V-shape says, it's just a healthcare kind of a thing. And when the health crisis is over, and they assume it will be over soon, another fake assumption, and then everything snaps back to normal the way we are. We will never go back to normal, and we will not snap back either, because coming out of this deep and rapid contraction, you know, unprecedented. No one's, you know, we've never been in this kind of deep, fast contraction before. No one knows what kind of economic dynamics are at work here and will continue apart from, in addition to the virus effect, no one knows. And the virus is not going away, no way. In fact, prematurely opening up runs the risk of a greater second and third wave. So the virus isn't going away, but that this whole V-shaped fantasy is based upon the virus going away quickly and nothing really changing fundamentally in the U.S. economy and the relationships between economic indicators and behaviors. I've argued that, look, business is going to use this opportunity to cut costs. They're not going to bring workers back the way they did. They're going to be very reticent and uncertain about the future. Therefore, they will not just return to normal. And the return will be very slow, very protracted. Businesses will not invest the way they did. Banks will not loan their own money the way they're loaning the government money once that runs out. And households will not spend. You know, and business models are changing everywhere rapidly, and households will be just as reticent about spending. Everyone's going to be hoarding, which means you're going to have a very slow recovery, even slower than the one after 2008-09, which was very slow.
Same thing to you, Jim Kavanaugh, especially the president saying earlier this week that, yeah, we had almost a 5% drop in GDP, but oh, by the fourth quarter, the economy is going to be booming. We're going to be right back. And to Jack's point, one of the big differences that I see between where we are right now in 2009 is the fact that this recession is based upon a virus. It is not as simple as just a downturn in the economy. It is a deadly virus, and that is going to, and already has, brought about a new reality for an awful lot of people about staying home, staying distant, hunkering down, and folks aren't just going to jump out like they would if it were just an economic issue. Your thoughts, Jim Kavanaugh?
Yeah, I mean, Jack's piece is great on this, and your remarks are true. There is now an element of fear that's been instilled in the population that isn't going to go away right away. So on the one hand, you have the population, the consumers, who are not going to be going out and spending freely. You know, they're not going to jump back in. First of all, they can't. They've been without work for 3 months. You know, if they've been given forgiveness on their loans and their mortgage and their rent and their car payments, nobody even talks about that. You know, they're going to have to make up for that when they get back to work. So, you know, they can't be spending even if they wanted to. But they're going to be fearful about going out and doing the things that they were doing before. Secondly, the businesses themselves, small businesses, restaurants are going to be destroyed, a lot of them, by this. They can't come back. 3 months of no revenue. And if they do open up, they're going to have to open up with fewer seats, more distancing, et cetera. So the whole structure, it reverberates throughout the economy where, you know, you're not going to have the economic activity. You're not going to have the growth that's going to push that V shape that they're talking about. You know, they're talking about whistling past the graveyard. I mean, you know, this is wishful thinking. And, you know, because they have nothing else to say, they don't really, since the economy is not socially organized and planned, and since there's no backup for people, there's no backup for small businesses, there's no income replacement for workers, where is this rocket up the other end of the V going to come from? It's not going to come only in the American economy. It only comes from consumer spending and from individuals, consumers making decisions to spend, not from any concerted, planned government program, social program that would put a floor on income and a floor on consumption. So it's very, very unlikely that this is going to be anything but negative economic news and for Trump. And that's, of course, what he doesn't want, because that is the main thing that is going to threaten his reelection.
Jack, following up on a couple of points that Jim Kavanaugh just made, one is talking about restaurants and when the economy does reopen, when restaurants are able to reopen and people are able to go back, the margins on restaurants are very slim to begin with. And so now these restaurants are going to reopen. They're going to have to service fewer people in the same working hours because of physical distancing. They're having to remove tables. Many are taking out bar stools. They don't want people sitting at bars. And we know that liquor sales are some of the highest margin items in restaurants. So you've got restaurants that are going to be working the same amount of hours, servicing fewer number of people. Their margins are going to be even thinner than thin. And the other point is, consumer confidence is one of those elements in economics that you really can't control. So when people can't trust what the administration is telling them, whether it be about the severity of the virus, they can't trust the actions taken by the government because it doesn't appear as though the administration really knows what they're doing, since they can't come up with a coherent message on how to deal with the virus, consumer confidence is going to be very difficult for the administration to reclaim.
Well, consumers constitute 70% of the economy, right? And if that confidence does not come back, and what you described in restaurants, you know, is replicated across all other kinds of service industries. It's not just the margins are narrow in that service sector. They're narrow in a lot of other service sectors. And you think people are going to go back to the movies? No. You think they're going to go to sports events? Well, some will, but if you have the distancing going on there, they're not going to be able to cover their margins. And you can repeat this across industry after industry. And as long as the virus is out there, people aren't going to be sure if it's coming back until there's an actual proven vaccine, which isn't going to happen for another 12 months. You know, you'll get a lot of these treatments, and they'll hype these treatments up to try to restore confidence to people who go out there. But you'll have these distancing and testing and all this going on for quite some time. And the bottom line, the consumer is not going to come back as robustly. And the same for the investor, by the way. And a lot of small businesses are going to go out of business, and therefore a lot of jobs are going to disappear. And even larger businesses are going to find ways to cut costs, and they're going to hoard their cash because of the uncertainty. You see, uncertainty is the worst factor for business investment and production and expansion and consumption. And the uncertainty and expectations of low profits and challenged incomes is going to continue for quite some time. What happens when the government engages in austerity, which is going to happen after the election? It happened under Obama. You know, Obama spent $787 billion in recovery, and then 2 years later agrees to take out twice that amount in austerity spending cuts. You know, you don't think that austerity spending cuts are going to come with a $5 trillion addition in the next 18 months to the national debt and deficits? $3.7 trillion this year, $2.2 next year. You don't think they're going to go after Social Security and education spending and everything else? Mm-hmm. Are they going to go after defense? Not Trump. Mm-hmm. Are they going to raise taxes on the rich? Oh, not Trump, and not even the Democrats, right? So where are they going to deal with these huge deficits? Well, they're going to take it out of spending, and that's going to slow the economy even more. So you got businesses hesitant to invest. You got consumers who are worried about spending. You got government that's going to engage in austerity. I predict that even if there is a leveling out here in the second half, maybe it won't continue contracting 40% like this quarter, right? Even if there is, we're running a big risk of a double and triple dip, re-recessions down the road 2 and 3 years. That's the pattern when you have these deep contractions so fast. That was happening in the 1930s. You had double dips. It happened in 1910. We had double dips in Europe and in Japan after this 2008 event. We actually had a double dip in the U.S., but we redefined GDP, so it looked like we didn't have a double dip, you know, in 2013-14. So it's going to, you know, it's not a simple V-shape or, you know, hockey stick. And it's not even a hockey stick down. It's going to be up and down, up and down, but at a low level of recovery, a very reluctant recovery. And that's the problem.
Jim Kavanaugh, your latest piece in Counterpunch is entitled Joe or No. And you write, here we go again. Now that Bernie Sanders has completed his predictable circuit of loss and capitulation, leftists, those who stand for socialist and anti-imperialist, or even serious social democratic and anti-war politics, again confront the quadrennial quandary. Must one vote for the thoroughly neoliberal and imperialist Democratic presidential nominee? Jim Kavanaugh.
Well, yeah, I mean, my article is my position that I'm not going to vote for Joe Biden. And you know, I'm not trying, I know I'm not going to persuade people who think they must vote for Joe Biden to do so. But my position is that, you know, I don't accept any haranguing me about my moral responsibility to do so or my moral irresponsibility if I don't. And, you know, I think Biden is a disastrous candidate. I think he's one. It's very difficult it's impossible, I think, to make an affirmative case about him for him from the left. Okay. And the only case that's being made for him is he's not Trump. And for those who think that's a dispositive case, well, then that's a dispositive case for them. But it's not for me, and it's not for many leftists. And there's no reason why it should be. I mean, I do not accept the fact that by default, as a leftist, you should be voting for a Democrat. I do not accept the fact that the Democratic Party has really anything to do with what I call the left. At this point, certainly it doesn't. And that it really is, I think, the main enemy of any progressive social democratic program. In fact, I think we see in the current context, and I say the main enemy because I say the Republicans could not stop a real social democratic program that a real opposition party wanted to do and actually went out and fought for and explained and used its allied media to support. You couldn't stop right now Medicare for All if there were the opposition party wanted it and used its allied media, which is CNN and MSNBC and the New York Times and the Washington Post, to support it. The Republicans couldn't stop it. But the fact is, the main enemy of it is not the opposition that comes from Republicans. It's the opposition that comes from the Democrats. And from my point of view, you know, whatever one thinks of what one is voting against, you know, for everybody, there's always a deal breaker. You know, if you were in a situation where both candidates were going to criminalize all abortion or criminalize all interracial marriage, you wouldn't be saying, well, should I vote for the lesser evil? The question might be, are you really okay voting for either one? And in my point of view, you know, in this circumstance, we've seen something. I think universal single-payer health care is an issue today that to oppose it is the equivalent of, you know, supporting Jim Crow in 1965. And I don't want to vote for that. You know, the party that spent the entire primary season fighting against and making sure through its allied media that using its allied media, making sure that they defeated universal single payer health care in this context is a party that really, I'm not good with that.
Jack Rasmus, today, this morning on Morning Joe, Vice President Biden was interviewed by Mika Brzezinski, and he claims that this sexual abuse charge, a sexual assault charge against him, is utterly false, ungrounded, unfounded, absolutely under no circumstance did it happen. He also then spoke about other how he would handle the coronavirus. To Kavanaugh's point, the Republicans, and I agree with him on this point, would not be able to stop a serious democratic socialist candidate in this particular context, but the Democrats seem to have been the party to do that. Your thoughts on Joe or No and Jim Kavanaugh's comments?
Yeah, well, first of all, you should realize that the national polls are totally irrelevant. The only thing that matters is the Electoral College in that half a dozen or eight swing states. And the question is, who's going to win those swing states, because everything else is locked up pretty much, you know, as a result of voter repression and gerrymandering and et cetera. I don't think these sexual issues, whether it's, Biden or Trump, will make any bit of difference. No one really cares about that. What they care about are the real issues, the economic issues now, the health issues, and so forth. And it's amazing that in the face of this crisis, that the Democratic Party doesn't jump 2 feet into the Medicare for All as the solution that would save all kind of money and save all kind of lives and relieves all kind of stress. But they're not going to do it, you see, because they are beholden to the insurance companies. You see, this is not the Democratic Party of your grandfathers. This is not FDR. This isn't even LBJ anymore. This is a party that's dominated by corporate money interests. They came in with Obama and they took over this party, and they get a lot of money from the insurance companies, and they're not going to go against insurance companies. That's, why the most they can do is a public option, which keeps the insurance companies in the game at the taxpayer expense. So you're never going to see that. What you got, in my view, is a single party, a corporate party of America with two wings, and I'm sympathetic to the views just expressed that you're not going to be able to reform this party. Sanders is a good chaotic example twice now of an attempt to do that. And Bernie says he was going to go all the way and fight all the way to the convention. Then Bernie throws in the towel once again. Progressives got to really think pretty hard about, any progressive movement that tries to reform the Democrats. And what happens when you do? I mean, two times ought to be some proof here that you better find another strategy. This inside-outside thing is a bust.
Go ahead, Jim.
As I say, I call the Democrats the Black Widow Party for the progressive left. It takes every progressive program and embraces it and kills it, co-ops and destroys it.
This, to me, to both of your points, the current situation that we find ourselves in this pandemic, even though Joe Biden came out and was very clear during the debates that if a Medicare for All bill came to his desk as president, he would veto the bill. This is the perfect opportunity for him to say, the new reality that we find ourselves confronted with and are going to have to adapt to has forced me to change my position. Here is the data. And when you have 30 million people that have lost their jobs, their health care should not be tied to their jobs. And what else do you have to say?
It's a political winner. I mean, it's the easiest
winner,
thing
winner,
to do
chicken dinner.
If you want to do it. But as Jack said, the Democratic Party leadership is bought by the health insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry. This is a huge industry. And what they're protecting is the right of private health insurers to make a profit. It's the only thing that's being protected here. But you can't. The opportunity is so vast. The Trump administration has instituted Medicare for all who have coronavirus. They have said we're going to pay for all testing and treatment of coronavirus victims through Medicare. The Democrats could come in and say, see, this is a great idea. Why don't we do this for people who have cancer too? Are they not worthy of this? But instead, people don't even know that this happened because the Democratic aligned media won't even talk about it. And it's amazing. This is an opportunity. And you can't concoct for me an opportunity that's likely to come up in the next 10 or 20 years that's better than this. You can say, oh, wait for what opportunity that's better than this one to get universal single-payer coverage. And the Democrats not only didn't do anything about it, they fought it.
Jack Rasmus, we have just about 2 minutes. And to this point, what a lot of people seem to forget is that Senator Barack Obama ran for president on the public option. And when he was elected, came into the White House, he had a meeting with the heads of the insurance companies. And they told him, under no circumstance will we support a public option. And that's how we got what became to what we now know as the Affordable Care Act And what the Affordable Care Act did was allow insurance companies to continue to make the money they've been making. Jack Rasmus, you got about a minute.
Yeah, well, you know, he immediately pulled the public option to get Obamacare passed. And, you know, I talked to a nurse at the time and she said, look, you know, this Obamacare, you know, all this is a health insurance subsidy act. That's what it mainly is, and moving the money around in order to keep the insurance companies in the game. And they supported it because they were going to get more business. You know, it's absolutely true. 75%, 80% of the populace is in favor of Medicare for all. I mean, what kind of more overwhelming public support do you need for Medicare for all? You know, and another travesty is what's going on with student debt. You know, the government is charging students 6, 8, 6, 7% interest on the debt. And what, banks can go and get 1 and 2%? Why is the government gouging our own students, you know?
I got to stop you there, Jack. Sorry, I got to get out. Thank you, Jack Rasmus. Thank you, Jim Kavanaugh. Gentlemen, greatly appreciated. Folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here next week on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.